here preparing a question for the president. On the David Nyers and William Hill. This is August 21st, David Nyers and William Hillman here preparing a question for the president on the idea of federalism, which the Constitution makers faced as contained. This question is arises out of this question in the outline. In the 18th century, federal union meant confederation or league. Anti-federalists charged that the new union was not federal but national. The authors replied, without any guiding precedent, that the union was federal in foundation, that is, state ratification, national in operation, that is, on individuals, federal in extent of powers, that is, enumerated and shared, and both federal and national in its amending power. Therefore, it was either purely, therefore, it was neither purely federal nor purely national, but mixed. Today we call it federal, but such type of union was new to its generation, and it is precisely this novel harmony and reconciliation of the state and national sovereignties which is the American contribution to government. All right, Mr. President, this is August the 22nd, and we'll start in answering this complicated thing.
Go ahead, Dave.
Well, we had a pretty good exposition here of a high-level way of saying something that not many people understand. Could you explain what was meant by this definition in terms we can all understand?
Well, the Continental Congress was organized by the colonies to meet a situation with which they were faced in their effort to become a free government. And after that free government was set up, they found that the Continental Congress was set up in such a way that it couldn't work for the simple reason that there was a clash between the sovereignties of the states and the effort of the national government to have a sovereign control over certain things. They had the Constitutional Convention and met that situation by defining the powers of the federal government. And in the preamble of the Constitution and in parts of the Constitution, you'll find where it says that those powers not delegated to the federal government remain in the people. It doesn't say they remain in the states. It says they remain in the people from whom they originated. And when that thing was finally worked out, and we'd worked about 80 or 90 years trying to find out how it could be best worked, we finally came up with the government which we have. The states have their function in the government of the United States. And the local governments, the counties and the cities and the townships, all have their place in the federal government. But when it comes to foreign policy, when it comes to the fact that international affairs are of great interest to the welfare of this country, and I think our forefathers foresaw that eventually, that it would come about, then you have to have a government which can act for the whole people of the United States. And that's true in a great many other things. For instance, in commerce, in interstate commerce, and in foreign commerce, only the federal government can act so that the contracts will stand up and be made good. And unless the contract's good, there's no use making it. And the powers of the federal government are those that are required for a great power. The local powers are those that the federal government should not in any way interfere with. They've had difficulties here lately with whether there should be a school a program so that the federal government could make contributions to it. And of course, the people who are locally running the schools are very much afraid that the federal government will come in and take control. I don't think that's true at all. If the people were willing to levy enough taxes to support the schools as they ought to be, they wouldn't be have any interference from the federal government, but they're not willing to do it.
Well, do you see any danger in giving more latitude or more emphasis to federal power?
I don't think there's ever been any time in the history of the country when too much emphasis was on federal power, except in the war between the states or the Civil War, as they've now decided to call it. And in our international foreign affairs, we must have the power in the federal government to act for the welfare of the whole country.
Has there been any serious straying from the original concept of the operations of the government since its founding to date?
Not since the war between the states. That strain came about then to a point where it finally wound up in a civil war, which was too bad and it should not have happened, but it did. And after that, the definite powers of the federal government have been established. The definite powers of the state's government, state governments have been established, and we haven't had any trouble since then to speak of.
But there have been violent changes as between emergency periods, so-called, or times of national emergency, and normal times.
Well, that's true, and the federal government has to act in times of emergency, and it always has. If Lincoln hadn't taken the bull by the horns and acted as he did, we wouldn't have any republic. Well, in the war, and Europe came along and Wilson had to take charge of things, he handled it in a way that had to be done. Franklin Roosevelt did the same thing in the Second World War. But after those things are over, the emergency powers are usually repealed and things go back to the normal state as they always have been.
Well, in terms of the swiftness of movements today because of communications and transportation and other speeding up things that have occurred in the relations of nations, it was all right in years gone by for presidents to have to go through the routine that they have to go through in their relations with Congress to get certain enabling movements. Isn't that a handicap today? Can a president move today in time to do the things he has to do?
Yes, he can if he wants to. All he has to do is take charge of things and move, because there are laws in effect. Communication, transportation, and interstate commerce, international commerce, and our relations with the rest of the world that are already in effect. And any president who wants to act for the welfare and benefit of the country, the whole, can do it if he wants to.
Now, you use an expression of he has to take charge of things and move. Now, what does he do? What does that mean when you spell it out?
That means when the emergency comes along, he's got to decide what's for the best interest of the country as a whole, announce what he's going to do, and the people go along with him 100% in every case.
Could you illustrate it with any particular action that you took that involved that kind of move?
Well, the recovery of the free world and the establishment of the rehabilitation and the economic recovery of the free world known as the Marshall Plan. In the case of the Greek and Turkish situation, when Greece and Turkey was about to be overrun by the communists, we decided that they shouldn't do it. Same thing happened in Korea, which was the most important decision that had to be made, because at that time, after the United Nations was adopted, it involved the whole world. And the people came along in the whole world and sustained that operation. And those are the things that any president has to meet when the time comes. Now, we've got a situation in Cuba. We've got a situation in the Far East, in Southeast Asia, that's almost as bad as what we were faced with at that time. We've got to have somebody now to meet that situation in the manner in which it'll work.
All right, now, what do you do from the conception of an idea to the action steps that you take in terms of, let's say, a Marshall Plan or a Greek-Turkish program, Truman Doctrine? What steps did you take?
You have to make up your mind what's right after you consulted all the information and gotten all of the authorities on the subject that you possibly can. Then you've got to find out what it's going to cost. You've got to call in the people who have to appropriate the money and tell them exactly what it's about and why you're going to do it. And in every instance, in my experience, there was no difficulty about getting that part of the program carried out. But the president himself has got to decide on a policy. Then he's got to tell the people what that policy is going to do. Then he's got to go to the Congress and tell the Congress what he needs and why it has to be carried out. And 9 times in 10, they'll carry it out.
Do you recall now, or maybe we'll have to do this later, how you, what people you called in, whom you called on in terms of names and dates? That's a little difficult now. We'd have to research.
Yes, I can tell you who they were. They were the leaders of the Congress that I called in when I needed the money for the Marshall Plan. I called in the chairman of every committee in the House and the Senate. I did the same thing in the Greek and Turkish program. I did the same thing in the Korean program. And after they'd heard the story, sitting around the conference table of the President of the United States, and asked all the questions they wanted and decided what ought not to be done or what ought to be done, I didn't have a bit of difficulty in getting the job carried out.
Well, in a certain sense, Mr. President, your attitude was the attitude that you have frequently expressed about lawyers. If you think a thing is necessary to do, you do it and then have the lawyers work it out.
That's right. And when you have to go to the Congress for the appropriations that are necessary to carry these things out. The Congress, no matter whether it's in opposition to you or not, will usually go along and help you get the situation carried through. That's true in everything but domestic policy. And of course, that's what we mostly fight about is domestic policy. And we should never fight about foreign policy when it's right and when it's been explained to a point where it can be argued through and decided that it is right by all concerned.
Well, then the impression we get out of this is that even though you were convinced that a certain action was necessary, you consulted with and informed all the people that were involved in the preliminary stages on a government level, and then as quickly as you could, you informed the people themselves.
That's
so
right.
That you never did it on your own, willfully. You never exercised power without...
Never tried to. The objective was to get the people who made up the government, which was the Congress, the United States, and the President himself. They make up the government. The coach are incidental and pass on things after they've been done. But the President and the Congress of the United States have to anticipate what's coming. And when that anticipation is explained, and the two branches of the government which make up the operation of the government, that's the Congress and the President, are satisfied that that's correct, then the next thing to do is to call in the public and tell them exactly what's taking place and what you expect to do, and you don't have any trouble. But if you commence telling the public what you're going to do before you do it, you never get anywhere.
In other words, Mr. Right. President, acting as a devil's advocate, a president who is just woeful and goes ahead without explaining his steps to all those that he's got to depend upon to carry out, is a president that will not succeed too well.
He gets into trouble. That's one of the difficulties that Wilson had, because he didn't take the Congress far enough into his confidence before he started on the League of Nations. If he had, he'd carry it through.
On the other hand, as in the case of Eisner, doesn't he go the extreme the other way by saying far in advance that he will ask for authority or that he wants to consult before?
Well, the President himself's got to have a plan and a program. Unless he has a plan and a program, he has nothing to sell. There's nothing to tell people what he wants or how he's going to do it. And if you wait for somebody else to make a plan and a program and then approve it, well, you never get anything done. That was true of James Buchanan. It was true of Franklin Pierce. It was true of Harding and Coolidge. And there you are. We don't want to have that situation develop again, although it's a possibility that it may.
And the problem a president runs is that he can either be premature in his pronouncements to the public, or he can be even more dangerously too late if he delays.
That's true.
Telling.
That's true. The public relations of the President of the United States is the most important asset that he has if he makes proper use of it. And even then, after he's accomplished the purpose and the thing has been carried through, they can still attack him on what he's done. But if he's done the job and it's turned out for the welfare and benefit of the people in the whole world now, since we're the world leader of the free world, what's the use worrying about what they think afterwards? It's what they're willing to tell you at the time. And most of these people who made the attacks on these programs, which I've just named to you, made those attacks long after they'd gone into, after the program had gone into effect and after they'd agreed to it.
Mr. President, this is the end of Tape 3 of August 22nd, in answer to a question of August 21st.
Oh.
Another question. The authors of the Constitution...
Wait a minute, Bill. Is this another one?
A correction. This is August the 21st. David Norris and William Hillman here framing a question for the President. The question deals with the ideas of democracy held by the authors of the Constitution. The authors thought of democracy as direct government by the people, impractical except for small places, and dangerous because it had no way of preventing the growth of factions. Republican or representative government was more stable because it was indirect and less liable to fall before a temporary but popular idea. All right, Mr. President.
Now,
on this?
Well, there's been a great deal of conversation about democracy. The communists, as usual, have debauched the word so it doesn't mean what it's intended to mean at all. Democracy is usually an organization that works locally. And a republic is a representative government which works after the cities and the towns and the democracies have decided that on the representatives that they want to represent their thoughts. And the Greek city-states never could agree among themselves. They always had to stand up and argue themselves out of the point of operation. Finally, it ended up in a dictatorship in Alexander the Great. And that's what happens when the situation is not handled in a manner so that deliberation can be had on the questions that are before the country. Now, any demagogue can stir up enough people to cause trouble. Maybe we've had that experience right here, and had we not have had a republic, we'd have been in trouble. As it was, the demagogues usually wore themselves out because they didn't have in mind what was right for the welfare and benefit of this great nation. The very fact that we have checks and balances in our government, and it's a representative republic, is the reason that we are the oldest government in the world today, and that we'll be a continuing government as long as we understand that a republic is what we are and not a democracy. If it weren't for the fact that the democracy was the federal basis of the whole thing, we wouldn't have a free government. But we have a free government for the simple reason that we have a government which deliberates on those things and those laws which are for the welfare and benefit of the whole people and is not carried away by demagoguery of certain people who want some special object, have some special object to be attained by a lot of conversation which doesn't mean anything. We've had those demagogues all through the history of the country. And I've got a lecture on the subject which I'd like to deliver once in a while.
Can you recall, Mr. President, now the names of some of the demagogues throughout history?
Well, the Alcibiades was one of the greatest demagogues who'd ever hit the Greek states. And he upset the free government of Athens and finally wound up so that Alexander the Great could come along and do what he did. Then we've had other great demagogues in the history of the country which were finally wound up by being dictators. Hitler was one of them. He's one of the greatest demagogues that the world ever produced, and so was Mussolini. But they were finally overthrown, but they had to kill a great many people in order to do it, and the free world had to wake up to the fact that they were very dangerous to have around. We've had some demagogues in our own country. Huey Long was one. He tried his best to overturn the government of the United States and set it up just like he had control of Louisiana, but it didn't work. And that's been true in several instances. We've gone through periods of hysteria that are as interesting as they can be. For instance, the witchcraft proposition, where religion was used to convict old ladies of being witches. And some 262 years after that, the Massachusetts legislature passed a bill freeing all those old ladies of having been witches. But it was a little too late because most of them had been drowned or shot or hanged or something of the kind that happened to them. We had the same thing in connection 100 years after that with the anti-Masonic proposition, which came up, and they had a demagogue who ran for president on the anti-Masonic ticket. Although he was a Mason, he made use of the situation, got himself seven electoral votes after a convention in Baltimore of the anti-Masons, and he was elected. And soon as that was over, they began then to tear down Catholic churches and tar and feather Catholic priests and go through all that anti-Catholic proposition. And then along came the Ku Klux in the Civil War, as a result of the Civil War, which was organized for the purpose of keeping the Negroes from taking charge of the government of the South. And that was revived in the 1920s, and we had a terrible time with it. They elected a governor in Indiana who was afterwards convicted and sent to the penitentiary because he was a crook. And he was a demagogue, and they'll come along, we'll have more of them. But the fact that we have a check and balance government, they never can get control of it because enough sane people are still there to keep that from happening.
In other words, it was not only an excess of evil intent on the part of these men, but excess of oratory, because in their efforts to persuade people, they got them inflamed.
Well, they had, knew how to appeal to the passions of the people. Well, that's the way they did it. They appealed to the passions of the people, and they, you can stir up a mob anytime you want to by taking a side issue and blowing it up to anything that happened to McCarthy. McCarthy is one of the worst demagogues we ever had in this country. The only man in the history of the country who succeeded in getting himself censured as a United States Senator. That never happened before in the history of the country.
Well, there have been good demagogues and bad demagogues, haven't there been?
Well, when they're good, you don't call them demagogues. They well, have an honorable, reasonable approach that will be for the welfare of the people. And they're not after the power for themselves, the good ones you name. I can name some of them.
Well, you're trying to distinguish between debate and just demagoguery.
Demagoguery, that's right. Yeah. Debate's perfectly all right. You want to debate every question, if possible, and know it from all sides. And that's the reason check and balance government, that is a republic, can listen to those debates and decide what's best for itself. And you can't do that in what you would call, in a democracy. It can't be done, except locally now, when you don't have more than a village or a township or a county. In a town meeting, you can argue the matter, and everybody's represented then.
In other words, because you have this machinery of representation set up, you have the process of deliberation, which won't lead to panicky action due to oratory.
That's correct. It isn't oratory. An orator is a man who understands the welfare of the people, and it's a great name. But these demagogues, I don't know. I don't know what you would call what they do. It's a sort of a weeping approach to a situation that will fool a great many people. And that's one of the reasons for the welfare of our government. We know how to stop it.
They're rabble-rousers.
That's the best word for it. They are rabble-rousers.
Now, Mr. President, the relationship, you speak of checks and balances and how under this republic, there is a due process, deliberation, all the things that have to keep things on a reasonable and sane level. Now, what about the injection of the party system into this checks and balances, and how does it work?
Well, I'll tell you how that came about, as far as I can find out from what investigations I've made. It was always customary in the early times for the House of Representatives to nominate a man for the presidency. And it became such a travesty that in the time of Jackson along 1832, in fact, the first party convention was this anti-Masonic convention, which was held at Baltimore. Then Jackson came along and organized a convention to nominate the president. And that was the first Democratic convention. And finally, in 1856, the Know-Nothings and the Whigs and the Anti-Masons and several others got together and organized the Republican Party in Michigan. And since then, they've been following the convention system. And up to now, it's the best system that's been organized for the purpose, because the delegates to those the different conventions are nominated and elected on the same basis as the congressmen and the members of the various congressional districts in the United States. And usually the conventions come up with a pretty good layout. It's about the best system that we can think of right now. And then after that, the states have to decide what they're going to do with regard to the electors that are to elect the president. And usually they go along with what the conventions have done. In some instances, they don't. In 1948, there was one a presidential elector down in Tennessee who decided that he'd vote as he pleased. He voted against the ticket. Tennessee Democrats had endorsed, and he voted for Dewey, but he didn't get anywhere with it. And there's no harm in that. But nearly as I can figure it out, and I've studied it very carefully, I don't know what you would have to succeed the conventions. If you want to go back to the congressional system and let the Congress, with each state having one vote, nominate a man for president, and have a the minority nominate a man for president, well, that's the only recourse that I see that we have.
Could you have national primaries to take care of that?
Yes, you could have national primaries, provided the federal government would meet the expense of those national primaries. That would be one way to do it. You see, the senators formerly were elected by the legislatures of the various states, so the states would have representation. And the Senate finally got to be a rich man's club, and a constitution amendment changed that so that the people of the states elect their senators now, and it might be possible for this national primary to accomplish the purpose that was accomplished by the popular election of the senators.
Could you have a national primary in which three or four people came to the top and the convention then could then choose among one or two or three of those?
Well, it's customary in the state of Missouri, I don't know how it is in any other states, to, after the primary, for a state convention to meet, write a platform, and endorse the action of the primary. That it might be possible to have a national convention to endorse the action of the national primary. If people wanted a popular forum on which to discuss what had happened.
Well, you've just witnessed a couple of conventions that didn't necessarily represent an ideal form of conventioning.
No, I agree with that, but then those things are bound to happen. But I remember back, I was reading an article about Sam Houston, and when the Democrats had four conventions in 1960, and old Sam Houston said, well, it was a good thing, and by the way, he didn't secede. They came very near hanging him in Texas because he wouldn't join the secessionists. But he made the statement that there's one good thing about that situation. It would do away with the convention system, but that's been 100 years and hasn't been done yet.
Well, but we can't afford to have even one convention leave the people with a situation where the people themselves are not fully represented.
No, I agree with that. I agree with that. But then those things are bound to happen, and we're faced with this. Old Grover Cleveland said we're faced with a condition and not a theory, and we've got to meet that condition.
Now, all right.
This is tape 4, August the 26th.